I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there. Hello, and welcome to the Mark Groves Podcast. I'm so excited to share the words of the man that is on the podcast episode today. His words I stumbled upon exploring the psychological processes of what's going on as a collective. You know, I'm very fascinated with not just human psychology, but also how our biology is impacted by how our mind works. You know, like what happens to our body based on our thoughts? What happens to our thoughts based on our body's response? You know, how do we take in information? Why do we miss some information? We all know about cognitive bias, you know, that we are biased to look for the things that we agree with. That if we have certain beliefs about the world, we will take in information that supports those beliefs and often unconsciously ignore information that challenges them. I think this is one of the hardest things to do, is to be open to information, even as someone who's aware of bias, right? Aware of not wanting to take that in. And what I do to attempt to dismiss that, not dismiss, but like engage in knowing that, is that I follow and read things that oppose the way that I am currently seeing what might be the subject. And that's hard, because of course I'm like, shit, that might be wrong. But I think, you know, as I've mentioned before, I think often of the words from Russell Brand, to always let our identity be fluid, to allow it to shift. And what that does is it makes it so we'll take in information that challenges our identities. I've been very curious about our inability to dialogue, especially about coronavirus and vaccines, and that being the only solution to what's going on in the world. Lockdowns, you know, I've been highly critical of lockdowns, and I think for very good reason. And I'm very curious as to why. I think this has always been true. Implicitly, this has existed, that we have a hard time dialoguing about things as a collective, especially in the most recent years, decades. But gosh, did it ever get heightened and turned up? It's almost like the inability is on steroids, you know, now. And why is that? Why is it that there's more on the line? You know, and I know that conceptually we might say, because lives are on the line. Sure. And lives are always on the line, and not just the lives of people with coronavirus, but the lives of the people impacted by the measures. And so I've been very fascinated about what is the psychological phenomenon that takes up groups, that makes us operate in groupthink and actually even collectively dismiss any voice that might be openly challenging it, but with data and logic. That's been really fascinating to me. You know, human systems really are interesting in how we want to group together on one thought, like that tribal groupthink, And also how it is so scary for us to use our voice when it is not part of the collective. And how does one do that? Because we have thousands of years, you know, whatever, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that have framed our nervous systems and the way we show up to the world to say that that is absolutely a horrible idea because you won't belong if you do that. And how do we, in the state or the threat of not belonging in our families or our friendship groups or in our community or our religions, because this is part of everything, how do you be you and still be in relationship? How do you hold on to yourself and be in love and be in community? And how do you speak out with the possibility of not belonging? You know, because there is this stretch where you might not belong to the group you're immediately within, and you do end up finding your group, finding a place where self-expression is actually a core tenet or value of belonging. And I think so many of our families and systems are actually kept together by silence, by people not pointing to the truth and saying, hey, pay attention to that. We all develop coping mechanisms and ways in which to be so that, you know, in our relationships, so that the truth is oscillated around, you know, and we develop addictions from the pain of this disassociation. And so I'm very excited to share with you the thoughts and mind of Matthias Desmet today. He puts into language the understanding of what does happen in groups and crowds and what could possibly be going on in today's world where we can't even orient sometimes around a logical discussion without being dismissed or name-called, and that being on both sides. So, you know, this isn't a one versus the other. This is how collective extremes work and the politicization of things. And so this conversation is so important. And I'm so grateful I get to have it and got to have it. And I'm so grateful for this space to explore these things as I explore my own dismantling worldview and allow my identities to die and fracture and also my ego. But, you know, also recognizing that it is the discovery, it is these conversations that lead to the discovery of what ways that you and I want to operate in the world and how we want to relate. And dialoguing and having discourse and building bridges between one another is how I want to live. And I will constantly strive to do that. And I think, you know, this podcast episode is another effort to do that, you know, continuously. As I said in a recent newsletter to those of you who are signed up for it, you can find the link in the show notes to this episode. I was sharing how my desire to explore the human experience moves so much beyond the relational experience, but it actually is interesting because it is all relational. So even if it's not in the context of romantic relationships, as you've discovered from this podcast, there's so much more to, I mean, all of it comes back to how we relate romantically because that is the magnifying glass to our challenges. But once you begin healing that, you'll start to see how you move in the world collectively. If you're codependent in romantic relationships, we're likely codependent in how we engage with our families, our friends, and our communities. And speaking out and declaring your truths, whatever that might be, is actually a way to heal that. And to learn how to do it with grace and compassion is the ultimate, I think, form of human expression. And so, without further ado, here is Matthias Desmet. Well, I'm so excited to have Matthias Desmet on the podcast today. Matthias, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you for inviting me.
You know what? When I first heard your words on another podcast, I can't remember which one, it felt like so many of the pieces of what I had so much dissonance about what was going on. And when I heard you speak, it started to make things make sense. It put into language what my body had been feeling. And I'm curious, just before we even sort of like dive into that, just for the people listening, you know, I think we often think like, why should I listen to this person? Why does this person have the authority or the background or the credentials to be able to share and postulate and all those things? So if you could share with people your background, maybe where you're coming from with that, and then we can get into it.
I'm a professor in clinical psychology at Ghent University in Belgium. I have a practice as a private practice as a clinical as a psychotherapist. Yeah, and also I also got a master in statistics, but I'm not a statistician. I'm not a statistician because I think that a statistician is someone who is involved in statistics day in, day out, and that's definitely not the case with me, or not anymore at least. So. But maybe it's important because in the beginning of the corona crisis, I often took a statistical perspective, trying to understand all the mathematical models and the graphs and that were used in the mainstream narrative. So the statistical part of my training definitely in the beginning of the crisis played a certain role. I don't know why you should listen to me, but just listen to me. Just listen to me and maybe you like it.
Right. Like maybe it makes sense. Maybe it sticks. Maybe it doesn't. And that's the beauty of being a human, that we can decide those things. And you spoke about the statistics at the beginning. I do remember at the very beginning, some of the modeling out of, I think it was King's College in London, but quite a few different places sort of giving us this idea that it was going to, I mean, we were basically under very imminent threat. And so can you explain like what happened for you when you started to run the numbers that then led to the exploration of the psychological interpretation and maybe what has gripped us? Because I'm really fascinated for myself, my exploration is this intersection of psychology, biology, and the spiritual too. And curious of, I was really shocked I don't know there's another word, that no longer could we have dialogue and discourse about public health policy. And I don't even just mean me. I mean, medical experts were being canceled for wanting to dialogue about these things, where I thought, isn't that sort of what science is this exploration and this ever moving and changing thing? So yeah, I'm curious what was the process?
Yeah. Of course, that's what science should be. But when science becomes ideology, it turns from an open-minded practice into a dogmatic conviction and belief. And that's maybe one of the major problems, ultimately, we are facing here. That we think that we follow science, but maybe we are following a blind ideology. And yes, for me, I work for almost the last 15 years. I've been working as an academic researcher, and I knew already that there are many problems at the level of academic research. And when I started to study the For instance, I don't know if you're familiar with the replication crisis in the academic world. Started in 2005, and it turned out that, for instance, in the medical sciences, in the biochemical sciences, 85% of the research papers are not replicable. So that's a technical term to say that if other people try to find the same or try to do the same experiment or study and try to repeat the findings that are presented in a certain paper, they will find something different. Okay, they will not arrive at the same conclusions. Which is a serious problem.
Yeah.
For within an experimental academic research discourse. But so at the beginning of the crisis, I started to be honest, I was skeptical from the beginning. And so from the beginning, I had a feeling that we might overreact to the virus. And I started to study the statistics and the graphs and the mathematical models that were presented in the mainstream media. And I had the feeling, or I believed that most models and most statistics such as the infection fatality rate, the case fatality rate, the mortality rates, and so on, overrated or overestimated the dangerousness of the virus in a dramatic way. And I was not the only one with that impression. You had world famous statisticians, medical statisticians, such as John Ioannidis of Stanford, immediately voiced the same criticism and the same concerns. And in my opinion, at the end of May 2020, so after 3 or 4 months, it was proven beyond doubt that indeed the initial models had been overestimating the dangerousness of the virus. The maybe the most important mathematical model, statistical modeling, were those of Imperial College in London. Those were the models that on which the corona measures worldwide, or at least in Europe and America, were based. And these models predicted, for instance, in a small country such as Sweden, that 80,000 people would die by the end of May 2020 if the country did not go into lockdown. Hmm. And it did not go into lockdown, and only 6,000 people died.
Wow.
Yes. And even then, that was, for me, that was the strangest thing, that even at the moment that it became clear that the initial models had been dramatically overestimating the dangerousness of the virus, the corona narrative and the corona measures continued as if the initial models were right, which is very strange, of course, because we were facing a narrative, a mainstream narrative, which claimed to be based on science and on mathematical modeling. So you would expect that if the mathematical models prove wrong, prove dramatically wrong, that then the narrative would change and that the corona measures would be changed. But no, the narrative continued as if the initial models were right. Hmm. And there are other things that I noticed from the beginning. Maybe the most important one was that in one way or another, the world seemed incapable of considering both dangerousness of the virus and the dangerousness of the measures that were imposed to the world. Because from the beginning, it was clear, actually, that the measures itself, for instance, the lockdowns, in itself would cause a lot of collateral damage.
Yes.
To give only one example, and there were numerous others, but the United Nations warned us from the beginning, I think in March or April 2020, in the first weeks of the crisis, that probably more people would die because of hunger in the developing countries as a consequence of the lockdowns than the number of victims the virus could claim in the worst case scenario, even if no measures were taken at all. And in one way or another, this didn't have an impact, and this didn't make us change the strategy to deal with the coronavirus, which, of course, is extremely strange. Because if you're confronted with a disease, with a pandemic, and you consider several options, several remedies for the disease, so to speak, then the first thing you want to know is whether the remedy will not be worse than the disease.
Right.
And that very elementary consideration, in one way or another, we were never able to really balance off the collateral damage of the measures and the damage the virus could claim. I noticed that from the beginning. It was striking to me that in one way or another, psychologically, it seemed as if the attention was focused on this one risk, this one dangerous aspect of reality. And all the rest disappeared in the darkness, was no longer in the field of attention, and had no cognitive and emotional impact anymore. And that was one of the reasons why, or that one of the things that I felt that should be studied in a psychological way.
Yeah.
I tried to understand what was happening in a population, in the world, in a society, that in one way or another, we were so blind for very important aspects of reality.
Oh. Wow. Yeah, when I think about all the things that you just shared, I went through a similar process in British Columbia in Canada, just like looking at more people were passing away from drug overdose, you know, and I've since the beginning thought about the psychological impact, you know, at least, you know, when you look at the policies of lockdowns, the data just, it was a new thing. It wasn't some like long established response to a pandemic. It was this novel new idea that we took from observing its quote unquote efficacy in China. And I agree with you. There's not been like, as more information came in, we didn't change the way we were interacting with it. And what I've been so shocked about is the inability to even have a logical, rational conversation. And this can be on both extremes, of course, but the fact that nuance does not exist anymore, that that's been canceled, that the gray has been canceled, that it's either all or nothing. And if you even want to explore and have the conversation we're having, often you are labeled as someone who doesn't care or have concern for human life. When I think to myself, like, isn't this the opposite? Isn't the exploration of what we're talking about actually the care and concern for the totality of human life? I think of the impact on children developmentally long-term. I think about humans and our need for each other, for eye contact, for smiling and for connection and touch. And I think of the psychological impact of sending both the implicit and explicit message that other healthy humans are biological weapons and biological threats. To me, I'm like, how do you undo that? You know, like, because so much of what you're speaking to is occurring on such an unconscious level, like people who love one another, families are saying, are divided and can't have these conversations. And to be able to put it into a psychological lens, what I love about what you're doing is that it's not personal, right? Like, you're just explaining a psychological phenomenon. And I think that allows us to at least observe, hopefully, are we part of this phenomenon? But I do also think that the dissonance of knowing you're part of that side of it, that might be more restrictive, more divisive, more is that we might not even be able to hold the capacity of that. Do you know what I mean?
I think so. Yes. Let me first add something to what you said in the in the beginning. And it is that indeed, in one way or another, if you didn't buy into the narrative, if you didn't want to go along with the narrative, or if you try to say something critical about the narrative, then people indeed blamed you of showing lack of solidarity and lack of citizenship.
Yes.
I think that is extremely typical for the psychological dynamic and the psychological process that I have been describing, the process of mass formation. Which exactly, when a mass emerges in a society, then a new kind of solidarity emerges, and a new social bond. And this new solidarity and new social bond is radically intolerant to dissident voices. So it's very typical of this process of mass formation I have been referring to and that I have been describing. Yes, but I describe it in an impersonal way. In the first place, I see it as a dynamic which emerges in a society and which grasps everyone, or at least a major part of the population. And indeed, at the second level, less crucial and less fundamental. Of course, some people take the lead in this process. Some people try to benefit from the process of mass formation. Some institutions might try to provoke the process of mass formation, try to stimulate it. Yes, indeed. But somewhere at a certain level, it is an impersonal process. Yes, that's true. Yes, and that in that way, it's also an alternative, I think, to a kind of thinking in terms of conspiracies, which is also too extreme, not nuanced enough, and in many respects, a little bit naive from a psychological point of view. I don't say there have always been conspiracies throughout history, and there are always people who are conspiring, and there are always powerful institutions who try to change society from a democracy into a technocracy. I think that that's something that is happening now. I believe there are certain institutions who would prefer to reorganize society and change it from a democratic system into a technocratic system, because they believe that this will be the only solution to the seemingly unsolvable problems we are facing now at the level of the climate change, at the level of healthcare and so on. But for me, that's not the ultimate level. I think the most fundamental level is a much more impersonal dynamic, I think, indeed.
So how does this process of mass formation begin, and how does it start to take shape? If you could walk us through that, that'd be great.
Yes. Well, it happens under very specific conditions. And sometimes, so a mass is a specific kind of group in which all people become similar. It's something very strange. At the mental level, people all start to think in the same way. The individual identity is replaced by a group identity. People become radically intolerant for dissonant voices. People become insensitive, for instance, or they are no longer aware of the damage that they cause to themselves. They become destructive towards dissonant voices, but also very self-destructive. Mm. They become, for instance, insensitive to personal losses and also, under some conditions, to physical pain, something very strange. Masses or crowds is another word, a crowd or a mass, have existed as long as humanity exists. But during the last three centuries, they became increasingly strong. And this has to do with the industrialization, and also the industrialization of the world, and also with our materialist, rationalist view on man and the world. So that are the real causes of why mass formation becomes increasingly strong and lasts longer throughout the last three centuries. So, and when does it emerge? So, a mass formation is something that happens in a society under very specific conditions. And the most important of these conditions, the first one, is that there has to be a lack of social bond. So many people have to feel socially isolated. And at this moment, or just before the corona crisis, many people did feel socially isolated. For instance, the Surgeon General in the United States mentioned that there was a loneliness epidemic from 2013 onwards. I think that about 50% of the people worldwide reported that they did not have one meaningful relationship in which they could open up on emotional matters and stuff. So one of 50% of the people, and then the United Kingdom and Great Britain, a loneliness minister was appointed because so many people felt lonely. There were many other indicators that the social bond really deteriorated throughout the last decennia, and actually it deteriorated from the 19th century onwards. It did not start 20 years ago. It started much earlier, but the last years it had become increasingly worse and extremely worse. It's extremely bad. So many a high percentage of the people in the population really felt socially isolated. So that's the most important precondition for mass formation. The second one is that many people have to feel that life is senseless or meaningless, or that they have to, at least they have to experience a lack of sense-making and meaning-making. Also, this was very clear in the last decade. We saw the emergence of the phenomenon of the so-called bullshit jobs. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but that are jobs that are experienced as entirely meaningless and senseless. And David Graeber, for instance, did a study in which he found that 60% of the people had the feeling that the job was meaningless or senseless. Wow. I think it was in 2018 in the United Kingdom and in Holland. And in a Gallup World Poll of 2018 also, I think, worldwide, the study found, or the poll found, that only 13% of the people felt that their job was meaningful. So only 13%. Yeah. And 60% Those were about the same figures as Graeber reported, felt that the job was entirely meaningless. And they sleepwalked through the office the entire day, having a pointless way, having the feeling that they didn't know or that they couldn't do anything that really was meaningful. So it shows that both the lack of social bond and the lack of meaning making were highly present in society. And then the third condition, also very important, is that there has to be a lot of free-floating anxiety and psychological discontent in society. And what do I mean with that? I mean with free-floating anxiety, a kind of anxiety in which that is not connected to a mental representation. So if we feel anxious for a dog or for something dangerous, we know what we feel anxious for. And in that way, we have the feeling that we can control anxiety because for instance, we can run away of the dog, but at least we have a minimal level of control because we know what we are anxious for. But sometimes people are anxious without knowing what they are anxious for. And that's a much more aversive mental state because that always threatens to change or to switch from anxiety to panic to a mental state in which you're confronted with a massive anxiety without knowing what you're anxious for. And so these first three conditions are all connected to each other. If someone experiences a lack of social bond, he will experience a lack of meaning making because a human being is a social being. And if it has no meaningful social, if it has no social bonds, it will also be confronted with the feeling that it doesn't know what it lives for. Yeah. And then the third condition, and if there is a lack of social bond and a lack of meaning making, people will be confronted or will experience, will be anxious and will feel discomfortable psychologically without knowing exactly what they are anxious for. Mm. And then the fourth condition also follows from the first three ones. And the fourth condition is that there has to be a lot of frustration and aggression, also free-floating. So people have to feel frustrated and aggressive without knowing exactly, irritable without knowing exactly what they are frustrated for. And if these conditions are fulfilled, if these conditions are met in a society, then something very specific might happen. If at that moment a narrative is disseminated through the mass media indicating an object of anxiety and at the same time providing a strategy to deal with this object of anxiety, then all this free-floating anxiety might suddenly connect to this object of anxiety indicated in the narrative, and people might be willing to participate in the strategy proposed to deal with the object of anxiety. And in that way, a kind of psychological advantage emerges, namely that all the free-floating anxiety now is connected to a representation, can be controlled by participating collectively in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety. That's the first thing. And then, if many people participate in the same strategy, they do something altogether, they altogether fight a heroic battle with the object of anxiety, for instance, the virus. And in that way, a new social bond emerges, a new social bond, which also leads to a new kind of meaning making in life. Suddenly, life makes meaning again because we live to fight the virus. And so, in this way, and then another important factor is that all the frustration and aggression that was circulating, free-floating in the society, can now be satisfied and can be directed at the group who refuses to participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, in the group who refuses to participate in the mass formation, or for the group who, for one reason or another, is not sensitive to the mass formation. And in that way, a highly aversive, negative mental state, lack of social bond, lack of meaning-making, free-floating anxiety, frustration and aggression, is changed or switches to a symptomatic positive state. in which there is a new social bond, a high connectedness, a new meaning making, in which the anxiety is connected to a representation and all the frustration and aggression can be directed at an object. And that leads, that switch leads to, from highly negative to highly positive mental state, leads to a certain mental intoxication.
Yeah.
Well, which is the real reason why people continue to buy into the narrative, even if it is utterly absurd, because that's so striking that in many respects, if you listen at the narrative and you look at the narrative, it's not rational at all. In many respects, you see that it is absurd, as we mentioned in the beginning, actually. But as soon as you understand that the reason why people go along with the narrative and buy into the narrative is not because they think it is right or correct or accurate from a scientific point of view. It is because it leads to the new social bond. And that's why the people always mention or reproach, if you don't go along with the narrative, that you lack solidarity and that you lack citizenship. Exactly, because that's what it is all about for them. It's about creating this new social bond.
So you have belonging, you have meaning, you have, as you said, this solidarity, which makes a lot of sense because a lot of the language, as you said, that's being used is you're selfish if you don't, you're this, you're that, which is interesting too, because when I think about some of the language of the political leaders in the world, there's a lot of, at least I could speak to the Canadian leader, Justin Trudeau, who said, we did the right thing. You did the right thing. And so because you did the right thing, getting vaccinated is what he's referring to, then you should be allowed to fly and not have to sit beside an unvaccinated person. And it's that language that, well, first off, that doesn't even actually make sense since people who are vaccinated can carry the virus, right? So it's like people should all have to present a negative test and then we'd all, that would be logical. And what's so fascinating to me as you're speaking to is like, I sometimes feel like I'm taking crazy pills because I'm like, wait, that makes no sense. Why would we do that? And then listening to other people just hop on board and create this divisiveness. Like I have friends whose families won't have them around for Christmas. And I have friends who are vaccinated, friends who aren't. I don't care what people choose. Mm. But what's interesting is like their parents won't allow them to come for Christmas because they're not vaccinated. And they're like, well, I'll bring a negative test. No. And I'm like, you should ask them to bring a negative test. Like that would make logical sense if everybody did. But how, like, if we're enrolled in this, you know, like if we're bought into this narrative and we found belonging and meaning in it, it's pretty hard to pull humans out of that, right? Like because I even find even wanting to have that conversation, although I do feel like people are more and more open to it. I am curious, how do you begin to even go against the momentum of such a thing?
It's extremely difficult. So, but we have to differentiate between three groups, I think. Yeah. So when mass formation emerges in a society, there is one group who is really into the process of mass formation and who is like in a kind of hypnosis. So because the mass formation is very similar to, it's actually one example of group hypnosis. And to these people, it's very extremely hard to wake these people up, exactly because the psychological advantage of being in the hypnosis is so big, because they switch from this highly negative mental state with the four conditions to the other mental state. So usually, probably, only about 30% of the people is in this state. And then there is usually about 40, 50, 60%. It depends a little bit on the exact the process in which how the process evolves, but usually about 40, 50, 60% of the people is not really, let's say, hypnotized, but they just go along with the crowd or the mass because they feel that it is much more difficult to go against it. The crowd and the mass, the 30% of the people, are one loud voice in society, and many people just will never go against the most what they perceive as the strongest group in society. So they will just go along with it, not because they really believe in it or not because they are really into this narrative, but just because it's in a psychological from a psychological point of view because it's easier to go along with it.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, and then you have the third group who are the people who are not in the process of mass formation, who are not hypnotized, and who want to go and who want to go against the mass or the current, and who try to speak out. And then, so the differentiation between the three groups is very important. Yeah. So, what can the third group do to wake up the first group and to convince the people in the second group to start to speak out or to go against the crowd? That's a good question. The first group who is really into the process of mass formation, usually you will not succeed in waking them up. Let's say it like that. Or at least it's very difficult. And so, but if people continue to speak out, the hypnosis will become less deep. And that's something very important. It's extremely important because a crowd or a mass always shows the tendency to commit atrocities. That's something that actually is logical because this fourth condition was the frustration and aggression. And the deeper, the more convinced the people become of the narrative that led to the mass formation, the more they will be inclined to believe that it is justified to act upon the frustration and aggression they feel. But if there are people who continue to speak out, then the process of mass formation will be disturbed and the hypnosis will become less deep. So that's something that was described by Gustave Le Bon, for instance, in the 19th century already. He said, usually, the people who are not in the process of mass formation will not succeed in waking the masses up, but they will succeed in making the process less deep, and they might very well be able to prevent that the masses commit their atrocities. So that's extremely important. And there is a second reason. So you have to know that mass formation, just like hypnosis, actually is a phenomenon that is provoked by the human voice, and that's why the leaders of the masses usually or always use propaganda, for instance. If you look at the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, which are all based on mass formation. So the difference between a totalitarian regime and a classical dictatorship is that the second one, the totalitarian regime, is based on a psychological process of mass formation, while a classical dictatorship isn't. And a classical dictatorship is based on a much more primitive psychological mechanism of the population just being afraid of the physical power of the dictator and his regime. But in a totalitarian state, it's completely different. In a totalitarian regime, state is based on this process of mass formation. And in this respect, it shows a completely different structure and dynamic than a classical dictatorship. And for instance, if a classical dictator succeeds in silencing the opposition, then usually his aggression will become milder. And if the same happens in a totalitarian state, if a totalitarian state succeeds in silencing the opposition in public space, then the totalitarian state starts to use his power and starts to commit his atrocities. And starts to become cruel in a completely absurd way. Then, to use the words of Hannah Arendt, one of the major scholars on the phenomenon of totalitarianism, then the totalitarian state will become a monster that divorces its own children. Something extremely important. Something extremely important. Once a totalitarian state, once there is no opposition anymore, once there are no people anymore in public space who speak out against the narrative of a totalitarian state, then the hypnosis becomes complete and the totalitarian state starts to commit the most absurd atrocities. This happened around 1930 in Nazi Germany and around 1938 in the Soviet Union, around 1935 in the Soviet Union. At that moment, the totalitarian state starts to kill basically everyone. The one group after the other is experienced as dangerous and is destroyed. And for instance, in the Soviet Union, Stalin in the end killed 50% of his own party members without them doing anything wrong. And Hitler planned to exterminate not only the Polish people, the Jews, the Gypsies, and some others, but also all Germans with lung and heart problems, for instance, and all kinds. And then he would have continued, just like Stalin, to kill group after group after group. And that's exactly because these leaders feel intuitively that the mass formation has to continue, and that it will only continue if they can indicate always new objects of anxiety that have to be destroyed. Because only in this way, this process of transferring a negative state in a symptomatic positive state can continue. And so that's the reason why the totalitarian state always, in the end, is self-destructive and always destroys itself. And that's exactly the difference with the classical dictatorship. But it's comparable to hypnosis, and that's the reason why it's extremely important that there are people who continue to speak out, to raise a dissonant voice, and who disturb this process in which a population is grasped in the resonance of one and the same voice of the leader, which in the end always leads them to self-destruction. So that's the most important thing, I believe, is to continue to speak out. It's an illusion that you can escape the danger of totalitarianism, of mass formation, by shutting up, being silent, and going underground. Maybe it's not bad to go underground in some respects, but that doesn't take away that if we do not continue to speak out, the situation will become graver and graver. So the most efficient way, the most important thing you can do in process of mass formation is, or the most efficient strategy is, so-called nonviolent resistance. And that's the most efficient strategy by far. Using violence, for instance, is meaningless, and it will only make the crowd or the mass feel as if it is justified to commit atrocities. The principle of nonviolent resistance, in the first place, just continue to speak out in a sincere, honest, quiet way, everywhere. It can be at the kitchen table, can be in a shop, can be on the street, can be on a podcast, or can be in a newspaper, no matter where. But if the people who feel and know that we are heading in a dangerous direction, in a self-destructive direction, try to do their best to speak out, they will all contribute to the final, ultimately to the solution of the problem.
That solution, you know, because of course, for a lot of people speaking out, I think there's a real, when I think about, you know, even my own personal thoughts on being totally self-expressed, saying everything I actually think, there's an innate biological fear of not belonging, which is interesting because I think, as you said, we have this fear of speaking out against the mass, but I think we forget that we belong to a separate group. Like, there still is belonging. There's belonging. And what I noticed too is when we at least say, hey, I'm not okay with some of the stuff that's going on, other people say, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you so much for speaking up. I'm feeling more inspired. That group of the 60% in the middle, group two, that group seems to be really the most important, doesn't it? Like, from the switch, you know, when I heard you speak before, you talked about giving people a greater object of anxiety. And when you speak to that tyrannical possibility of a tyrannical state, is that ultimately the path, or is it also creating dissonance? Like, can you also speak to what is illogical, or does logic kind of go out the window? Like, is that not the sort of path, you know?
Yes. I think offering a new object of anxiety, for instance, indeed, the possibility that a totalitarian regime might emerge, is something that can help to convince people. Sometimes it can even wake them up, because in one way or another, you undo the process of mass formation. You can explain that in a technical way. I did it in some other podcasts. I don't think it's necessary to do it again now. But you can do that. But of course, replacing the one mass formation by another is maybe not a very fundamental and good solution.
I see what you're saying.
Yes, and maybe it's not very ethical as well. I think it's good to warn people. We have to show them and tell them, like, look, it's dangerous what we are doing. But we shouldn't really, I don't think that's the most important aspect of a solution. I think just this process of the crisis we are going through now, I think it's, in one way or another, is the ultimate manifestation of one way to organize society, which is based on control and power. And the real solution is, and then this way of organizing society is embedded, is based on a materialist, mechanist view on man and the world. And I think in this crisis, what we might go through is the ultimate switch from this old structure of society and this old view on man and the world to a new one, which is no longer based on control and manipulation and the use of power, or at least not in the same way. And I think that's the real profound, that's the solution that is really the ultimate solution. We shouldn't try to convince people to go back to the old normal. That's completely counterproductive. It won't work, because the old normal was terrible for most people.
Right.
The old normal was where people were confronted with their bullshit jobs, where they suffered from burnout, from depression, from anxiety, from lack of meaning making, from lack of social bond. So it makes no sense to try to convince people to go back to the old normal. The reason why the mass formation emerged and happened was exactly because the old normal was terrible. But what we can try to do is we can try to make people realize that there are several options for a new normal. The new normal doesn't have to be a technocratic normal, where everybody is tracked and traced, and where everybody has to, when there is social segregation, and where everybody has to show a QR code when he wants to enter a shop, where everybody is subjected to mandatory vaccination programs, and so on. No, we can get rid of our depression, anxiety, bullshit jobs, and meaninglessness and senselessness in another way as well. Huh? If 90% of the jobs are really meaningless, then it means that 90% of the jobs don't have to be done. That's what Keynes said already in the beginning of the 19th century. He said, by the end of the 20th century, we will need to work only, I think, about 10% of what we work now. So, and that was true. But what he didn't realize, or what he did not could have predicted, was that we would create more and more senseless jobs. That's a strange thing. That's one of the very strange phenomena. Why do we create meaningless and senseless jobs? Jobs that actually that we don't need. It's a very good question, and that kind of questions we have to solve to find a real solution to the problem we are dealing with. And that those problems, problem of the bullshit jobs, of the senselessness, are connected to the fundamental way in which we conceive life, in which we think about being human. That's, in one way or another, now the dominant view on man and the world believes that the human being and the world and the universe is a kind of a mechanical device, a machine, which functions without meaning or orientation. And I think that Most people believe that this view on man and the world is based on science and based on radical understanding, but it isn't. Science showed us exactly that the universe is not a machine and that we cannot understand it completely in a rational way. That through rational knowledge, we cannot really know other people. We cannot really know the universe. We cannot really know the world around us. That the only way to know the other things, the other people, is by resonating with them. Poetry, Niels Bohr, the famous physicist who won the Nobel Prize, said, when it comes to atoms, language can only be used as poetry. He said that there is no way, even material particles, such as atoms, cannot be understood in a rational way. They behave in a completely irrational way, ultimately. And the only way to really get in touch with them and understand them is by writing poetry about them. Mm. And that was only one example of what I mean. Most other famous scientists eventually, in the end, concluded the same, that something escapes rational understanding and that it is exactly at the limit of our rational understanding that we are really, really able to understand something, paradoxically enough, of what is real. Someone as René Thom, the famous 20th century mathematician, said that the great scientists were not people in the first place who had an extraordinary capacity for rational understanding and for logical reasoning. He said they had an extraordinary capacity to feel into the objects that they were studying, to feel, to resonate with the objects they were studying. That's what real knowledge is. Real knowledge is being in harmony, resonating with what you want to know, without trying to force it into the categories of your own understanding, of your own rational understanding. Because if you try to do that, you destroy your object, or at least you make it disappear after the categories of your own understanding. So I think that the real revolution or the real solution to this crisis is not finding one or another cure for a virus. The real solution is much more situated at the level of finding a new way to understand the world around us, to get in touch with the world around us, a new way of relating to other people and to the world around us. It's at that level that we have to find a solution. And if we get rid of our social isolation, our isolation from nature, the lack of meaning-making and sense-making, of our anxiety and frustration, if we get rid of that, we will not only see that we overreacted to the virus, but we will also be not so scared anymore of dying and of death and disease, I think. And at the same time, our immune system might function better, because nothing is worse for our immune system than senseless stress and anxiety. The mortality rate of lung viruses increases with 40% in mice populations who are under chronic stress, and up to 80% in human populations. So I believe that the psychological level and the philosophical level, and the spiritual level, if you want, is the ultimate level in this crisis.
So beautiful, you know, this invitation back. You know, that's what, just from hearing you speak, you know, what I hear is this, like, we've gone so far into this need to control the world, understand the world, make it make sense, put it in these categories, that we've gotten so far away from it, from how it works, from trying to control ourselves, from dying, from, you know, all these different ways where, you know, I was joking with my fiance the other day saying, imagine if the whole purpose of life is just to remember to return to the land and to return to one another and to community. And, you know, I love the declaration that we are not going back to the old. Like you're right. No, that's where the discontent was. That's where the loneliness epidemic is. And, you know, there's this opportunity for us all to converge and not live in this space where technology rules our lives. You know, these phones have become, you know, they're obviously incredible because they can connect ways of thinking. I think they've created global consciousness to be tangible and connected, and people see other ways of living. But like any tool, when it becomes this endless chase for dopamine, and we're constantly in this state of stress, it does more damage than good. And it also gets exploited, as you said, the technocracies. I mean, companies and shareholders of those companies are rewarded for getting us on our devices more and less in person and less scared. You know, when you're on the devices and watching the news, you're not in your heart, you know?
And the virtual conversation, such as the one we have now, is not the same as a real conversation. Right. At the psychological level, it's something completely different. And also at the physical level, make no mistake, when people talk with each other and in the real world, then their bodies resonate with each other constantly.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't happen when they talk to each other in virtual space, because now we see each other's face. Only each other's face. For instance, there is a very small delay. When people talk to each other in real conversations, they react to each other in less than 0.0 seconds, which is 5 times faster than in traffic. It's I've been studying natural conversations for 15 years, and it's unbelievable the way in which people are connected when they speak to each other in the real world. Also physically connected, is incredible. And it's exactly that aspect of being connected, this symbiotic resonance with each other, that satisfies one of the most basic needs of the human being, namely to be connected. And technology, in one way or another, allows us to communicate, to exchange information. And sometimes we also feel connected at a deeper level, but it's never the same as real conversations. And that's probably one of the reasons why the more people are connected through the internet, the more lonely they feel. It's very striking that the more industrialized, the more technological a country is, the more technologically developed a country is, the higher the levels of social isolation. Of course, it can be due to many factors. We have to be careful not to suppose that there is a causal relationship too quickly, but at least there is a correlation between the two.
Well, even speaking to you, mentioned that stat from 2013 onwards about loneliness, and you know, it's interesting because that's basically around the birth of Instagram and probably a larger uptake of Facebook, but also Twitter. And, you know, speaking, I know Jonathan Haidt talks about this in his book, Coddling of the American Mind, this fact that when you feel like you're surrounded by so many people, but you're really not connected, you know, and we're trying to fit in and belong in those states. There's just so much self-worth that's on the line in like what pictures you post, what highlight reel you have on your Instagram. It doesn't surprise me that with the continued expansion of smartphones and social media, that there is actually less connectedness. Although we would look and say, but I have so many friends on Facebook, or I have so many blah, blah. And it's like, no, get out in the real world, put your feet in the dirt, sit down with your friends, hold hands, hug, kiss, you know, be connected. Matthias, this has been such an honor, and I'm just so appreciative of your perspective and your time and your courage to share your feelings about what's going on and the psychological organization of what's going on. Because I think it puts into words what so many of us were trying to understand. And that is a way out. You know, that's liberating in and of itself, because what it does for the person listening, and it has for me, is it gives context, and it also makes us feel less alone, right? It makes us feel like we belong to this group. Maybe it's the 30, maybe it's the 60, maybe it's the other 30, but at least now we're, I think it's so important that we learn how to deconstruct how human systems move together, because they do, and how propaganda does hijack our amygdala, how it is used. And this process of what's going on, I love that you spoke to what can emerge from this, is that we are actually being able to witness so explicitly, and in a way, really ignorantly, just like propaganda, censorship, everything, just as if they don't even give a shit. Like, it's so obviously happening that I feel like it's waking more people up than it ever did. You know, of course,
those things existed. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. That's true.
So
that's a nice thing.
Yeah, yeah, please go on.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for listening. Yeah, I'm happy that you gave me a way to speak out in the world.
Well, the people who listen to this podcast are just incredibly inspired to learn more about the human condition and human psychology and relationships and how we move together and how to do it better, how to unify, how to be successful at relationships and learning how to dance in the nuance of human systems and how to help, you know, move us through this into in birthing something new and better and more collective is incredibly valuable. So thank you very much.
Okay.
So before we go, though, where do people find more of you? Just so, yeah.
Oh, I believe on the internet. No, I just published, I'm about to publish a book. I finished a book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, on the same topic as we have been talking about.
Perfect.
Now. But it will first be published in Dutch. It will be translated soon in American and in some other languages as well. But I don't know yet when the English version will be published and will be available. But I suppose it won't take too long. I believe it might be in March or April next year.
Perfect. Well, we'll keep our eye out for that, and we'll make sure we put that in the show notes. And we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If this episode resonated with you, one of the best ways to support the show is to go subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any more. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it, or share the episode with your community on Instagram or whatever social place you like to hang out. This helps get it into more people's ears, and I'm so grateful for your support always. Thanks again for tuning in. Much love.